This is a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Z-Talk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Our military service members volunteer to protect us in the most dangerous places around the world. They step up. And when they are severely ill or injured, returning to their families is only the beginning of their long road home. Beyond all the hospitals and doctors and surgeries they need just to survive, they also deserve whatever they need to truly live. All the in-home care and day-to-day help they need to live independently, on their own terms. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs were established to provide these brave men and women whatever they need to continue their fight for independence at no cost for life. So many of them need us, and it's time for a grateful nation to step up. Find out how you can do your part at findwwp.org.
Connecting. Access granted. Begin download. Download complete.
You are listening to The Buzz on the Z-Talk Radio Network. Imagine the possibilities with Kevin Thompson and Molly Spence. The best in alternative talk radio.
Well, welcome everybody. You are listening to your favorite Monday night program. You're listening to The Buzz on ztalkradio.com. And I'm proud to announce that, again, we're still broadcasting or simulcasting on TalkStream Live, but tonight we are on Pyramid 1 as well. So we thank everybody for listening in. If you're new to the show, we cover the gamut. We cover all things paranormal, metaphysical, cryptological. I mean, we try to cover
we do it all.
We do it all. And you're being joined by your usual host and hostess. We've got
Molly
and Kevin. My God, Molly. You know, it seems like just a couple hours ago I was sitting behind this mic. Where did this week go?
Well, you have several shows that you do, so that's probably why it feels that way.
Man, it's like, my ass is like fusing to this chair. So, Lord.
I was going to tell our listeners we may have an extra co-host here tonight. I have a female quail sitting on my windowsill that is quite, well, I don't know what they do. What do you call that?
I don't know. It's not a chirp.
Or
it's
chirping, or I don't know what it is, but just. If you hear any strange noises, that's what it is.
Yeah, nobody's getting choked in the background or anything like
nobody's
that.
Nobody's being murdered or,
at least not on your end.
No. But for some reason, she wants to sit on my windowsill.
Well, I mean, maybe you have an admirer.
Well, I don't know. Usually, as soon as they see you, they run or scramble off the other direction. But I've been moving around here, and she doesn't seem to mind that a bit. So, I don't know. It's just me and birds, I think.
It's because you're
so
lovable.
They seem to be attracted to me for whatever reason.
You're just so lovable.
Alfred Hitchcock should still be around, because he could do a remake of The Birds here.
But, doggone it. I'm checking the chat room and everything. Veronica or Veronique says that she believes that she has a couple of people who she think would be great. Oh, wow. See what kind of night it's going to
be. It's going to be one of those nights, isn't yeah. it?
And I swear to God, I am stone sober sitting here drinking Kool-Aid. Maybe it's the red dye number 5.
It must be.
But she thinks she has a couple of guests for the show. So, Veronique, send them our way. And to all the listeners, if you have somebody that you feel would be good for the show, would be a good guest, and, you know, somebody that's entertaining and well-spoken, please, we take requests. We really do. And I will contact them, or Molly will contact them, and we'll get them on the show.
Yep.
And it's weird where you get guests from. I mean, sometimes they solicit you, or sometimes you pick them up from other shows, or you listen to another show, and you're like, I wonder if they really answered their email. And I'll be doggone. You know, we've been very fortunate, Molly.
We have. We've had some awesome guests.
And, you know, each one is gets harder and harder and harder to beat. So, you know, I don't know what to do. How high can we set that bar?
I don't know. But, you know, it is everyone's show, our listeners' show. So, you know, we do want to get their contacts or whatever, you know, if there's somebody that they'd like to hear, and, you know, any suggestions you may have.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I enjoy it. I appreciate the show, you know, not just because, you know, it's entertaining, but you learn something, or it validates something that you feel that you have known for years, and you thought you were the only person that thought that way.
Mm-hmm.
But tonight's kind of exciting because I've already done a show with this guest on House of Mystery with Al Warren. And he was such an awesome guest, I had to bring him to the Buzz. And like I said, off air, Molly, this one's kind of really kind of a nostalgic show because we on the Buzz are returning tonight to our roots, which is paranormal investigations, just good old ghost hunting.
Well, we don't actually hunt.
Well, you know, that's a good
point. We're paranormal investigators, not hunters. We don't hunt. We don't do it for the thrill of it. We do it to help people.
Yeah, there you go.
Help people and spirits, those on the other side. So,
I stand corrected.
If we can put the rest and let them, you know, go on over, well, then that's, you know, our challenge has been met.
Yes. You know, because I guess, you know, whenever you say the term ghost hunter, and you know, shame on me, you know, I'm properly chastised because you're absolutely right. You know, you think of the Scooby-Doo gang, you know?
Yeah.
Out there running around in cemeteries in the middle of the night with flashlights and cameras.
Well, you know, so many people, though, they say, oh, we're ghost hunters, and that's exactly what they do. They go out for the fun of it. They don't know what all is involved, and they just do it for the thrill of the hunt, pretty much, and scare factor and so on and so forth, which, you know, that's what they want to do. I guess it's okay, but that's not what we do.
Right. Or tonight we're going to learn a whole new term. We're going to learn about detecting paranormal or being a paranormal detective. Our guest tonight is Greg Lawson, who is a paranormal explorer, international lecturer, and author. Now, Greg Lawson is also, I'm proud of this, is a 10-year military veteran and is a career law enforcement officer who is currently a patrol sergeant in Central Texas. Now, has an expansive and diverse background along with his academic studies, which leads to his interdisciplinary perspective on education, training, and human interaction. Now, since 1982, Greg has served in the United States Army as an infantry parachutist and in the United States Navy as an operations specialist. And get this, Molly, he's almost made a complete circle in the United States Air Force as Security Forces Combat Arms Instructor.
Oh, wow.
He's only got two more services to go, Marines and Coast Guard. So,
cool.
But... But he's received his master's degree in education, specializing in management of technical education, adaptive systems, and how to manage change in large organizations. And he's a proud alumni of Texas State University. And he's also a paranormal explorer and has written a book called Detecting Paranormal. Discussions on how to become a paranormal detective. So we've kind of jumped around tonight, Molly. We've started with ghost hunting to, you know, what would you say? You know, paranormal investigator. And now we're going to be talking to a paranormal detective.
So can we go from investigator to detective?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Are there ranks?
You know, it almost sounds like
there is.
Did
we start out as hunters and then went to investigators? And now we can maybe go on up to detective now.
You know, maybe we could. Is it like, you know, like karate? You know, when do I get my black belt?
My belt.
But he was such a wonderful, wonderful guest, listeners, that I wanted to share him tonight and bring him on the buzz. And we're going to talk about all of these things and how to become a paranormal detective. So if you guys would like to call in at any point during the show, if you have any questions or comments, or you want to weigh in on the conversation, or give us your thoughts, give us your experiences and share them with Greg. You can call in whenever we open up the phone lines, and that number is
262-672-2488.
All right, everybody, we'll be right back after this news break, and we'll be joined by Greg Lawson. So stick with us, everybody. We will be right back. You're listening to The Buzz on ztalkradio.com.
The tale of the tape. I'm Pam Pluso, Fox News. The White House still hedging on whether or not recordings exist of private conversations between President Trump and the former FBI director. Fox's John Decker is live at the White House.
The question of the possible existence of a White House recording system has lingered for more than a month since President Trump first raised the possibility in a tweet about James Comey. Now the Secret Service has told the Wall Street Journal that the agency has no audio copies or transcripts of any tapes recorded at the White House, and White House spokesman Sean Spicer was noncommittal about the existence of a taping system.
The president made clear in the Rose Garden last week that he would have an announcement shortly.
There is still the possibility that recordings could have been created without the Secret Service's knowledge. Pam?
Thanks, John. We can expect more public testimony on Comey and the Russia probe tomorrow from Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
The president disagreed with and continues to disagree with the fact that Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation. And now Sessions is going to talk about all of that, plus his meetings with Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the United States, and other issues regarding Russia.
Fox's John Roberts at the White House. Another setback for the president's revised travel ban. A federal appeals court panel in Seattle has upheld a decision blocking it from taking effect. The White House believes that ultimately the ban will be upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. A little levity at the White House.
Today I'm truly proud to welcome to the White House our college football playoff national champions, the Clemson Tigers.
President Trump applauding the team for, quote, willing its come-from-behind victory over Alabama. He called the game's finish inspirational. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow down 35 points. Fox News, fair and balanced.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/newscast. That's ZipRecruiter.com/newscast. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/newscast.
With Washington hyper-focused on Russia, President Trump is trying to change the subject back to his promise of job creation and workplace development. As part of that plan, the White House is spearheading an apprentice program in order to fill jobs that employers can't find qualified candidates for.
Apprenticeships teach skills needed to bridge this skills gap. An apprenticeship combines a paid work component with an educational component. Apprentices earn while they learn.
Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, it's unclear how much the apprenticeship program would cost. In the hands of a Minnesota jury, the case against a police officer.
St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez is charged with killing Philando Castile last July following a traffic stop in a St. Paul suburb.
Fox's Jeff Manasso in our Midwest Bureau. Castile mentioned he had a gun, and Officer Yanez maintains Castile reached for it. A flurry of complaints from fighter pilots led the Air Force to sideline some aircraft, and that hold continues.
Just days after the Air Force said that it had not grounded but merely temporarily paused air operations for the F-35 jet fighters based at Luke Air Force Base, while they investigate half a dozen instances of pilots complaining of hypoxia or lack of oxygen, now the 56th Fighter Wing that oversees the F-35s in Arizona says the pause in flights will continue. Major Rebecca Hayes, a spokesman for Luke Air Force Base, issued a statement, quote, "The safety of our airmen is paramount, and we will take as much time as necessary to ensure their safety."
Fox's Jennifer Griffin, a former Navy flyer, is celebrating a big birthday. Former President George H.W. Bush turned 93 today. The former president said to be celebrating with family at his home in Kennebunkport, Maine. Pam Puso, Fox News Radio.
You are listening to The Buzz on the ZTalk Radio Network. Imagine the possibilities. Now back to the show with Kevin Thompson and Molly Spence. The best in alternative talk radio.
Well, welcome back, everybody. You're listening to The Buzz on ztalkradio.com here with Kevin and Molly. And joining us for the next couple of hours is Greg Lawson. Greg, welcome. Welcome to The Buzz.
Thanks so much for having me.
The pleasure is ours. And like we were joking, this is a first. This is a first for me, at least. You know, the listeners and Molly, they all know I can see, you know, who's listening. And you must have a fan in the Russian Federation, Greg.
I hope so. I hope I have more than one.
So a big shout out to Russia, but I'm almost, hey. Should I say that or not?
Yeah, I think you should. I'm going to Russia. I just don't know when. It's going to be soon, though. And then within the next 5 years, I got to go over there.
And do
what I do. I need to go to some paranormal sites, see what's going on, see what kind of beer they're making over there, the important stuff.
And there you go.
and not in that order, right?
Well, not necessarily.
Yeah, the beer first, and then
yeah, that helped.
That way, one way or the other, you're getting spirits, right?
Correct. That is my my whole goal.
So for the listeners who aren't familiar with who you are, Greg, tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you here to this point.
Well, I'm a 30-year or thereabouts law enforcement officer. I have worked patrol and mental health and sex crimes and a short stint in homicide. And I've traveled around quite a bit, so I have written a couple of books on the subject, and now I go to different paranormal sites and try to figure out what's going on. So it's pretty much in a nutshell.
Now, how long have you been investigating the paranormal in and of itself?
Well, I would have to qualify what you could consider an investigation. So I've been dabbling in, I guess, paranormal since I was a little kid. I've always been very interested in, monsters, starting off back in the original, vampire movies, up into my teens. And of course that in the late 1970s, early 1980s, equated to, driving around in cars, drinking beer, going to abandoned houses, going to graveyards and places like that. So I did that. And then of course, being a paid investigator, as far as being a cop and also being, as a certified investigator / detective, as a mental health officer, I did a lot of investigations on individuals that were claiming a paranormal situation, whether it be angels or demons or alien abduction, that sort of thing. So as a lot of people don't know what paranormal investigators are, what mental health investigators are. Mm-hmm. When someone is experiencing what a normal person would say is psychosis or delusion or hallucinations, they will call, the cops on this person who's acting out. Cops get there, and they're either already certified mental health officers, or they will call one there. And a certified mental health officer is somebody who is a cop, but he's been trained in a certain way. And you go there and you conduct your investigation of what this person's claims are. So, I did that for a few years professionally. And a lot of times I didn't have, the real time to go back and investigate the paranormal side of it. But I would go through, the steps on the mental health side of it. So that can often, go together. So I did that. And then a few years ago, I wrote a book called Zombie Advocacy, and it was a satirical manual on, when the zombie outbreak happens, how is it really going to happen, and how are we going to handle it, which is going to be completely different than The Walking Dead. I love The Walking Dead. Don't get me wrong. I haven't ever missed an episode. However, that is not how it's going to happen, because I've studied pestilence, I've studied outbreaks, and diseases don't migrate that way. Viruses don't behave that way. So unless it's just completely anyway. So in that, I had a lot of people call me and come to speak at paranormal conferences, and I then transitioned more into assisting other paranormal investigators in their investigations, trying to concentrate more on industry standard and best practices, as opposed to just a night vision camera and kind of running around in the dark.
Yeah, the Scooby-Doo
wondering
gang.
Why they're seeing what they see or don't see, and being creepy. Because as you well know, if there is a haunting, and if it is happening, it's happening in the middle of the day also, most likely, when it's mm-hmm. sunshiny and there's butterflies out and people picnicking and, it's not just at midnight. I don't think. I mean, it could be, but.
You're right.
We're always asked, why do you investigate at night? Is that the only time that they're out? It's like, no, it's just quieter then. And, you can do your recordings and other necessary work in the quiet.
That's right. And a lot of people don't look at it that way. A lot of people look at it as, especially with the night vision thing, it degrades your your visual spectrum. And in doing so, it creates these anomalies and it creates these artifacts in a digital media that can look very unusual. And it's, you know, it's either just an artifact or just something that's stimulating the digital media, or it could be something else and you just don't know what it is. So that's my take on it. I don't know. I assume it's happening all the time. I've had people say, well, you know, midnight is a special time of the night, and that's when we're closest maybe to the spirit world, and that's why a lot of people do things around midnight. But I don't know. I haven't seen the evidence on that.
Well, here's a real practical reason that a lot of investigations happen at night. We work during the day.
We have a job, yeah.
Or the places we're investigating are a business or, a household that has children. And, you can't do things during the day that you may be able to at night.
And I've gone into some of those places in Austin at night and gone in and turned on all the lights, and everybody I'm with are like, what are you doing?
Yes.
Like, I want to see what's going on. They're like, well, yeah, but it doesn't work that way. It's not quite as interesting when you turn all the lights on.
But you can see better, and it saves a lot of stubbing the toes.
Yeah. It was really funny. I was did a little time on a SWAT team, and it's interesting, we would go into a house and we're using lights, and there's all kinds of tactics that you can use lights on your weapons and so forth, and we go through this house and we use lights, and it's really funny because the older guys just go in and turn the lights on. Just flip the light on. I was like, I don't have to use my flashlight, the light's on.
There you go.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of different tactics that people adhere to, that they believe in, that works best for them. So if turning the lights off, keeping the lights off, and doing that works best for you, then okay, that would be your experiment that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then my experiment's going to be with the lights on if we got lights.
Or try everything and see what works best for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Main thing is I try to push consistency, because if you're working all over the spectrum, which you can, as long as you're paying attention to what happens in each one.
Yeah.
Then you have no median to go off of. You don't have any base.
Yeah. I was meaning, from one time to the other, not right. All the same evening.
Yeah, right.
That would get a little crazy.
Now, earlier, I want to kind of rewind a little bit, Greg, because I've been mulling this over in my head the last few minutes. You brought up a really, really good point when you were talking about mental health. Now, I work in corrections, and so we have got a large segment of our inmate population that deals with mental health issues.
Yeah.
And now, having experience in both of those worlds, law enforcement and coming to the truth and, reading people, but also you have a foot over here in paranormal. Whenever I have an inmate with mental issues that's telling me that they're hearing voices or they're seeing things, how do you filter out this is mental health. No, this over here is... you're might be actually experiencing something spiritual.
Well, it kind of depends. That's the thing about paranormal. A lot of people bring pseudoscience into the paranormal to try to explain what people are experiencing. So best practices on this is, first you do your basic interview, which is who, what, when, where, why. Just kind of get the conversation going with this person, and then sit back and allow them to tell their story, tell what happened to them. Now, depending on the level of their mental illness, and also the level of deterioration that they've experienced in the illness, or the amount of time that they have experienced away from their medication that is lending back to whatever the hallucinations or delusions that they usually have. You go in and you start dissecting what they're telling you. In other words, if somebody is experiencing, let's say, possession, and they've been abducted by aliens, and they have a you know, an attachment haunting that follows them all the time, and they they have the whole spectrum of the paranormal world with them, that, in my opinion, degrades what they're saying. So even just because someone is experiencing, just because someone is diagnosed with a mental illness, does not mean that they're not experiencing whatever they say they're experiencing. So I'm not going to tell somebody that thinks that they have an attachment haunting that follows them everywhere and does whatever it is they do to them. I'm not going to try to eliminate that and just explain it off simply as mental illness. And it very well could be. But I know for a fact that no one can, affirmatively prove that it's not a ghost. Mm-hmm. And that's where pseudoscience comes in there. You know, yeah. It's like, okay, I can't prove it's a ghost, but I can't not prove it's a ghost. So we got to keep that door open. Now, realists and rationalists will sit back and say, well, I understand mental illness, and this is what happens in mental illness, and this person is experiencing this, and so we're going to give them medication, and everything, and that's fine. That is a worldly way to deal with that. But I always just kind of leave it open. Now, the argument to everything happening, like I have a ghost in my house, I have aliens abducting me, I have a demon that, is threatening to kill my family, I have all these things. You could go and look at some of the religious beliefs in Islam, or some of the other beliefs where you have a jinn. Rosemary yes. Ellen Galley has written a book on it and talks a lot about the jinn. And the jinn are basically, they don't like humans and they like jacking with us. And they change their forms and their methods to suit what scares us or what bothers us or what affects us. So once again, the paranormal thing is completely open to interpretation, and that's why you have so many people saying there are so many different things going on, even with one incident. I can ramble on more. I'm going to shut up now.
Oh, no.
go ahead.
Yeah, this is your show. I mean, you're absolutely right. And, it's funny you should bring up the jinn. Let's look at it from human terms. There's all different types of people. Why would there not be all different types of spirit beings? Especially given the vastness.
The funny thing is the religious, the individuals that are very religious will roll their eyes at that idea, what you just said. Yet in the Bible, you have all kinds of different levels of angels, all kinds of different levels of demons. All kinds of things that are happening that had there not been one deity assigned to this would be considered paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
But they accept it readily.
Because, for example, I'm sorry, Molly, go ahead.
No, I would say because it's religious based rather than paranormal.
Correct. And mm-hmm. any of the miracles that have happened that they talk about, devoid of religious dogma, is paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to offend anybody, but if you just look at it as a definition, it's the burning bush that's talking to you. That's pretty paranormal right there. I don't know how much more paranormal you could get than that.
True.
Except that one entity was charged with that, was the Holy Ghost. Hello, ghost, ghost hunter, ghost investigator. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So, it's the dogma that's written down that's accepted by the majority of the people that is correct. So where you know, typically we believe that we're correct. There's a whole bunch of countries out there that do not believe that we're on the right trail.
And certain spirits, since we're mining this vein here, certain spirits seem to have different types of personalities, just like us.
And they're described that way, especially the angels.
Yeah, Jesus encountered demons, and there was this one child who was possessed of a spirit, and it would either throw him in water or throw him in fire. That, to me, that's just unusual. Why those two things? You know, why not jumping off roofs? Why not doing this? Why not doing that? Why those particular things? And then Jesus encountered the man in the tombs. And said, well, who are you? And they said, Legion, for we are many. Well, right. Have you come to cast us out before our time? Well, no, but since you're here, you know, well, can we go into those pigs over there? You know, you have all these different types of personalities and spirits. So, you know, you're right. You know, without Jesus having been there, this would all have just be chalked up to, well, let's call it supernatural. Because they feel more comfortable with that term.
Right, right. And nothing, you know, I grew up Catholic. And, you know, I never really quite understood the separation when I had friends of mine that were Baptist. You know, where I am, you have a strong Baptist community. You have a pretty strong Catholic community. And I would invite them, hey, you want to go to church with me? And they're like, no, we don't. It's like, well, what's the problem? And I never really got it. I didn't realize, you know, how different the Catholic religion is from the base Christian religion, you know, and it's just a lot different. There's a lot of things that they do differently. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I've kind of experienced that when people, I am Jewish, but whenever you get around evangelicals, you know, and you tell them, well, you know, I'm a paranormal investigator. It's like, you can feel the air leaving the room.
Oh yeah, you bet you can. The interesting thing about that is you know, I've been in those situations where, you know, individuals will roll their eyes and just kind of, oh, that's weird. But you know, you get them one-on-one, they'll want to tell their ghost story.
Exactly.
It seems like everybody has one. It's like, you know, now that nobody's around, hey, you know, one time this is what happened to me, or this is what my grandmother used to do, or, you know, my grandfather told me about this. So it's all underlying. It's all there. It's just whether or not people feel free to openly discuss their experiences.
Yeah, and they always give the right.
I was going to say, I don't think a lot of that, though, just falls on religion, religious values. A lot of it, you know, from my experience, that they find that they're worried about the neighbor thinking they're crazy.
Oh, yeah, or at work. You certainly don't want to say, you know, you have to be very careful as a cop that is doing anything like this, because you know, if you say when you take your MMPI, your Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, 600 questions or whatever it is now, they keep adding more questions to the thing. When you take that and you say that you've seen, you know, a ghost, because there's several questions like that. Yeah, you get deducted a lot of points when that happens. So you really have to pay attention to, you know, it's not, you're right. It's not at all just religion. It is, it's banking, it's business. It's, you know, anyone who openly shares those sorts of experiences can expect to have ridicule.
Now you can get around the psych test. You know, your MMPI and your MCATs and all of that, right? Because it's asking you, do you see things or hear voices that aren't there? Well, right. Prove to me that they're not there.
That's right. How would they know that they're not there? Yeah,
exactly.
They are there.
That's what... my wife and I were watching Bates Motel. I don't know whether you guys have been watching that. It's on Netflix now. I'm not sure what station it's on. But anyway, that's one of the best shows out there that really concentrates on how someone who is having delusions or hallucinations really experience them. What people get confused about is if someone is diagnosed with mental illness and they're having these experiences, it's not like a cartoon running in front of them. They actually see the dog that's following them around. Now, in some cases, it could be a purple dog, and that's fairly unusual. However, they see that dog. It's there. It's not like it's floating in space doing something weird. It's a dog, and it's doing, you know, its dog thing. Some, obviously, dogs, if somebody's having an experience, the dog is talking to them. Well, there's a whole bunch of really interesting explanations on why that happens. And that would be a completely different show. But just because that does happen to them does not, and they're diagnosed, does not mean that it's not happening to them. Doesn't mean that it's not paranormal. And that's where I try to steer a lot of paranormal investigators, is as soon as they find out somebody is diagnosed, you know, with schizophrenia or whatever it might be, well, then they'll disassociate from them and they'll, nah, that guy's crazy. I'm not going to talk to him. There's no reason why you shouldn't go ahead and follow through, unless it's some sort of danger there. But you should go ahead and follow through, because you don't know, as we had talked before, you don't know where that rabbit hole is going to take you. And it might take you to what you're looking for.
Well, you know, I have to agree. And Molly and I have been in this situation when we've investigated. You know that the person is suffering some type of illness. But here's a thought to keep in the back of your head, that maybe that illness is making them either A, more susceptible, or B, more open and receptive to the spirit world.
Yes, absolutely. And it could be C, their experience from this caused the mental illness. So you can always throw that in there, because talk a lot about, you know, alien abduction. Well, you know, if you're abducted and you're taken on a spaceship and they perform procedures on you, there's a good chance you're going to have PTSD. I mean, if that really happened to you, there's a good chance that you're going to have a real problem with being abducted, being held against your will, and having, you know, experiments on you. And it's not always probed. And so a lot of time it's probed, but it's not always that. So, you know, maybe their supernatural or their paranormal experience actually led to, you know, their difficulty with reality.
And sometimes demonic oppression can actually appear as mental illness.
And there are a lot of people in a lot of different groups that absolutely believe that.
And, you know, Molly, isn't that the first thing that a lot of people tell us, though? And I'm air quoting, you're going to think I'm crazy, but.
Yeah. It's the first words that come out of their mouth.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they tell me, too. Yeah. You're not going to believe this. You're going to think I'm nuts, but, you know. I did a talk the other day in Rockdale, Texas, at the Rockdale Public Library. And that's Bible Belt stuff in Texas, right? I mean, when I grew up in that area in the late 70s, early 80s, if you spoke anything outside of the realm of Jesus, it was sacrilege. You know, it was evil, demonic, that sort of thing. So to have a paranormal researcher, you know, a paranormal detective to come to their public library and speak, you can tell right away that the attitude there has changed quite a bit. And the further interesting thing was, I had four or five people that, you know, talk about certain experiences that they had, or, you know, it started off with, I know this person that told me this happened to them. And, but it was pretty amazing that they shared that in an open forum like that,
yeah.
Especially there. So this is, you know, a lot of the TV shows have helped out that a lot, has gotten the word out. And you know, you watch any of the TV shows, you can tell these people aren't demons. You know, they're not going after demons. They're just trying to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
But, you know, when the show started out, you know, years ago, when the first paranormal show started out, they were leading people to believe that all spirits were demonic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they're not. You know, yes, they are. There are some, but the majority aren't.
And that comes from, one, no training in investigation and just grabbing a camera and running around in the dark. Two, not understanding what you're researching.
Right.
If you don't have a background in some sort of studies that has to do with, you know, Western esotericism as far as, you know, metaphysics or something to even have a baseline to go off of, you know, you're going to lead people way astray, because your interpretation is just going to be based on your personal experience and no real research. So,
and that's why I have a problem with the labeling of ghost hunter versus paranormal investigator.
Right. And you know, I throw that out there because I kind of look at it as steps in a ladder. And, you know, a ghost hunting, let's go to the cemetery and run around and see if we can, I don't mean literally run around, I mean, go there and, and collect, try to collect evidence of something paranormal. You're hunting, you're not doing any research, you're not doing any investigating, you're just going out and hunting ghosts. And you can do that, you know, a lot of the urban explorers, kind of do that. They just see an old building and they decide they're going to go over there and bring their cameras and recording stuff and just kind of go in there. And basically, you know, they might not necessarily call themselves ghost hunters, but they're looking for something weird.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. That's what I did when I was, you know, in high school. And, yeah, and
it's like a rite of passage.
When I was first in the military. But there's, I talked to somebody the other day, so I've done firearms instruction for a long time, and most firearms instructors go to a 5-day course to become a firearms instructor, and then they start teaching firearms, and they very rarely go beyond that. And when they're teaching firearms, they typically teach flat-footed shooting your gun at a paper target. And then everybody goes home, puts their guns away, and then that's pretty much all they ever do for the rest of their life is they go to the range, they stand flat-footed, shoot at a paper target. When, you know, that's like teaching a child how to walk and never teach them how to run, or teach them, you know, some basic words but never teach them how to write it, and then never teach them to, you know, write prose or poetry or whatever. There's levels to this. So as a ghost hunter, which is fun and you can come up with some very interesting things, the next level, it would be an investigator, you know, finding out what is the legend here, going and seeing if they can, you know, and talking to people that might know about the legend and going and seeing what kind of evidence you get. And then I kind of bring it a little further as far as, you know, you can, it's all semantics, but from investigator to detective, I am more of a skeptic. Now, people get very confused about the word skeptic and cynic. If you are not a skeptic as a paranormal investigator, you're going to see faces in, you know, a glass of water. You're going to come up with all kinds of, you have to be skeptical about what's going on. You have to figure out the natural thing that happens first and get rid of that and say, okay, did this natural thing happen? Did this? No. Well, I don't know what happened. So you do that. And then, I always give an example of the ghost wagon of Westlake. So there's a story about a wagon being pulled by a team of horses with an old man and a dog in it, and he's in the wagon is filled with cotton. Now, this would have been a common occurrence in the 1870s to 1890s in the Austin area. And so the legend is, over in a little town called Westlake, Texas, there's a road called Camp Craft, and Camp Craft goes across a small stream. There is a graveyard right there at that small stream, and that small stream overflows from time to time and actually does damage to the graves that are in there. And at certain times of the year, it gets foggy down in there, and they say that you can see the ghost wagon of Westlake going through the fog right there at the crossing. Now, what I've learned from that is there's some writings in the 1960s of these kids that were spending a lot of time down there, and they had witnessed this crossing of this wagon with its occupant and the horses. Now, we could sit here and look at that all day long. Okay, is a horse a ghost? Is a wagon a ghost? Well, no. Okay, well, then is it a residual haunting? Well, I don't know. It's clothing and material. Could it have been a psychic impression kind of thing, where something so emotionally charged happened there that it's, you know, it kind of imprinted itself there? Or is this maybe a crossroads for some sort of physical thing that's happening? Maybe we can see back in time for that particular moment, and it's a little, you know, just a time flash. You know, we can try to explain this in a bunch of different ways and then go out and do our investigation. Well, I went one step further. I said, okay, this is my story. Wagon, horses, man, dog, cotton. Let's see what I can come up with this. So I checked the maps in that area back to the 1840s, 1830s, 1840s, and see who owned those properties at that time, and how the transition happened as far as who took over what property. And then to see what kind of events happened in that area. And you come up with certain things, and where you find most of the stuff like that is going to be in the old newspapers. And the old newspapers are maddening to read because, you know, the print that they had, as the stories came in, then they set the type, and it would, and, you know, so they didn't have like the murder section, and they didn't have the, you know, the sports section.
Yeah, it was all over the place.
Yeah, it just kind of flows. So you have to read the whole damn newspaper in order to come up with anything, because there's no way to really track it. So you got to read a whole bunch of newspapers. You're looking through all kinds of stuff and microfiche and all that. And so out of that story, this is what I come up with. In the 60s, there were some kids playing around down in that area, and they found a grave, and there were some bones sticking out. They went over and told their parents. Their parents came down and said, oh, that's Maurice Moore's grave. He was a cotton farmer that was riding through here and was ambushed by the Comanches and killed, and they buried him here. And so they reburied the bones and just went about their business, because there's a lot of graves in that area. Well, the interesting thing about it is I know who Maurice Moore is or was.
Yes.
He was actually a deputy that worked in the Austin area. And he wasn't killed by Comanches. He was killed by the McNeil brothers, who had burnt down his wife's schoolhouse. So there's a whole different story that's going on right in that area. And there, that hill where the stream is coming from was marked as Moore's Hill back in the 1870s. So when you start looking at a whole bunch of stuff, it starts coming together. Okay, now let's look some more. And yeah, there was a cotton farmer that was killed in that area, very close. And the highwayman that killed him took his wagon, his cotton and his horses into Austin, had it ginned, and sold it all. So once you start digging some more, then you look and find out in the 1960s, there were some kids that reported this man and his dog that they were looking at, and he walked over a hill, and they went to find out what he was doing, and he just disappeared. So we have four separate stories going on here that turn into the contemporary legend of the ghost wagon of Westlake.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm going with the paranormal detective side of it, is going beyond just the legend, beyond the ghost story, and actually pulling up records and finding those sorts of things and deciphering exactly what the legend was, if there was an a legend at all. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, it is similar to what we do, Molly.
Yeah, it is. Especially that one that we did up there in Hazel Green.
I will send you a certificate.
Are we going to have to share it?
It'll be beautiful. I'll get some of those gold stickers and stuff and put on it.
Gold stars all the way around the border.
Oh, it's pretty nice.
Now there's got to be an order to this, though. Do you perform the on-site investigation first and then go through records looking for validation, or vice versa?
Vice versa. If I do anything, if somebody wants me to help them, I typically don't do on-site. And I don't do on-site because I've been told multiple times I take everybody's buzz away from them. I've been told by two different mediums that my presence doesn't help the investigation much. And of course, I've been told by other mediums that, oh, that's not true. You know, you're fine, and that wouldn't have anything to do with it. But when I go overseas, when we go overseas and do some of these, I'll do on site here in Austin, the Austin area. I typically don't do on site, and it's just because we have enough investigators. I belonged to a group that was all law enforcement, and so, you know, I have complete trust in them, and I know their history. I've worked with them, and I know that they're solid. If I am working with some people that I feel that would benefit from me being there, then yes, I'll go. Other than that, you know, that's the sexy stuff. I kind of like not doing the sexy stuff. I kind of like digging through the records and old photographs and that sort of thing. You know, I'd talk to people and they're looking for answers. And a lot of times it'll be to, a death of a family member, that sort of thing. And, I try to guide them in that way. Like if it's an older family member and they're trying to find out, I always guide them toward the genealogy side of it and have them do the work first before they're, going beyond that. So I try to eliminate the tangibles first and then go into the paranormal investigation side of it. But I do go to all of the, the paranormal sites. I'll go there, but it just not necessarily will I go there with equipment.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yes. Because what our method is, and tell me what you think of this, is we will actually go on site first and, find out what's going on. We'll do the interviews. We'll do the readings. We'll get our baselines, or we'll do communication if a spirit is present. Then we'll take what we've got and then try and match it up with historical records. Can I prove what happened here? Can I prove what this spirit said? Because if I can't, it's just a fancy story.
And, the way that you just described that is a lot cleaner than the way I describe it. Because if you go to the site not having any expectations of what you're going to experience, that evidence is a lot cleaner than the person that goes, okay, this is going to be a little kid that got ran over by a tricycle that had a squeaky wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And, and yes, Everybody's going to be listening for the squeaky wheel. I heard it,
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You're going to have all this, audio phenomenon. Man, you could hear the squeaky wheel going around in circles or whatever. And so the way that you're talking about doing it is much cleaner that way. I just, it usually takes me 6 months or so to do my research, because I'll go through everything I can possibly go through, and I'll spend time at the historical society, and they help out a whole lot.
Yeah,
I don't know if y'all have a local historical society.
Oh, absolutely,
awesome. We do.
Mm-hmm. We're in the South, yeah. So
matter of fact, I am in the historical society in the small town that I'm from back in Alabama. So mm-hmm. I get a lot of information that way.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah. I've got Molly, and then we have our other historian that works a lot with our team. Is Jackie Reeves. And if it has happened in Huntsville in the last 200 years, she's probably written a book about it.
That's incredible to have people like that, you know, on your team. That's golden.
Well, it takes, you know, it's again, it
takes a village, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it absolutely does.
Because if we can't prove what happened, what do you have? You know, you're just kind of either validating their fears or you're feeding into a situation, you know, like you said, you know, or we'll front load the investigation if we don't right. have those people available, but don't necessarily have to bring them with you. You take your information to them.
Right. Yeah. I think what is more important in your investigation than the results of your investigation is how you do your investigation. So if you have a pattern that you do your investigation, you have a mode of operation that you do, that every time you do those particular things, that will give you that baseline that you need. So when something truly extraordinary happens, you'll be able to recognize it. It's huge.
True. That's a good perspective.
Well, a lot of people try to, you know, what is your motivation? Is it to go in and support a ghost story, or is it to go in and figure out what's going on?
Well, yes.
And so that's a big deal there.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit deeper, Greg, on the other side of the break. There's that awkward pause.
No, sorry.
I thought Molly was going to say something. Good. Okay.
I thought he took a nap there for a minute.
Yeah, I was like, okay, awkward. All right, everybody. Well, listen, we're going to go to our next news break here. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by the second half of the show by Greg Lawson. So everybody, we're going to open up the phone lines in this second half, and if you'd like to weigh in or you have something you'd like to add to the conversation or maybe share an experience that you have had and see what Greg thinks about it, you just call in, and that number is
262-672-2488, and we are waiting on your calls.
And I promise, I promise I'll let Greg answer, okay?
Maybe we'll get one from Russia.
You know what?
Wouldn't that be cool?
It would. That would be awesome. Although I don't speak much Russian. So. All right, everybody.
They probably understand English or they wouldn't be listening to the show.
There you go. See, that's an
answer. Oh, touche.
That's language detective right
there. Yeah, I started to say that's the difference between an investigator and a detective.
That's right.
All right, everybody. Just sit tight and we'll be right back. You keep me up.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow. NPR's Tamara Keith reports the White House isn't saying whether Sessions will answer questions about his conversations with President Trump.
Senators have a lot of questions for the Attorney General about what former FBI Director James Comey may have said to him about President Trump, about his involvement in the firing of Comey, and meetings Jeff Sessions had with the Russian ambassador during the campaign. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked whether Sessions would invoke executive privilege if asked about conversations with the president about Comey.
I think it depends on the scope of the questions, and it would be to get into a hypothetical at this point would be premature.
When asked whether the president was okay with Sessions testifying, Spicer simply said it is happening and the White House is aware of it. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
The attorneys general of Maryland and the District of Columbia have filed a lawsuit against President Trump. D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine says the president violated the Constitution by letting his businesses accept payments from foreign governments.
My office window is just a few floors above where we're sitting today. And I can tell you that as I look out the window and see the tower of the Trump International Hotel, we know exactly what's going on every single day. We know that foreign governments are spending money there in order to curry favor with the President of the United States.
The Trump Organization has said it would donate profits from customers representing foreign governments to the U.S. Treasury, but will not require the customers to identify themselves. Tens of thousands of anti-government demonstrators took to the streets in cities across Russia today. Hundreds were arrested, including opposition leader Alexei Navalny. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports from Moscow.
Under blue skies, security forces massed in Pushkin Square, a vast public space in central Moscow. Barricades went up, helicopters circled, lines of police in body armor and wielding batons pressed protesters, and the protesters surged back. Government security forces never appeared to lose the upper hand, and by late afternoon here in Moscow, protesters had either been dispersed or hauled off to jail. Alexei Navalny was not on the streets. The 41-year-old lawyer has emerged as the most visible critic of President Vladimir Putin. Navalny was arrested as he walked out of his house to join the demonstration. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Moscow.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 36 points at 21,235. The Nasdaq Composite down 32. The S&P 500 down 2 points. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The philanthropist Agnes Gunn has announced she will sell her art from her private collection to raise money for criminal justice reform. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
Agnes Gund recently sold a major work by Roy Lichtenstein for $165 million. According to the New York Times, it was sold to hedge fund billionaire Stephen Cohen. Gund says $100 million from that sale will go to the new Art for Justice Fund, described as a movement to end mass incarceration. Other collectors have also promised gifts of art or donations to the fund, which is being managed by Rockefeller Philanthropy Partners and the Ford Foundation. According to a statement, the fund will support efforts to cut the prison population and strengthen programs to help people when they leave prison. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is recommending that the new Bears Ears National Monument in Utah be smaller. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports this is part of the Trump administration's controversial review of more than two dozen national monuments that protect public lands.
This recommendation is part of an interim report and could still be revised. It does signal, though, that this administration does not favor rescinding the new 1.3 million acre Bears Ears Monument altogether. Instead, they want to shrink its boundaries to include just protection of the ancient artifacts and cliff dwellings. Secretary Zinke is also calling on Congress to give Native American tribes co-management authority over the new monument. And under the original proclamation signed by President Obama, tribes only had an advisory role.
NPR's Kirk Sigler reporting. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Never coming down. Ever since the day she left the ground, she ain't never coming down. Ever since the day she left the ground, she ain't never coming down. Ever since the day she left the ground, she ain't never coming down.
Everybody, we are back. You're listening to The Buzz on ztalkradio.com. And as promised, joining us for the second half of the show is Greg Lawson. Now, Greg, before we left, we were kind of talking about the differences between investigators and detectives. And that brings up a really good point because you were in law enforcement for 30 plus years. Do you think, is there a way that you kind of combine your law enforcement experience with paranormal detection?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I like I said, when I watch the shows, I kind of like, well, okay. And depending on which show it is, of course. But when I would watch the show, I'd think, man, that's a fundamental error that they're making there, that if this was a crime that happened and you had to go before a grand jury to do a deposition, you would get a no bill on your evidence, because a lot of people confuse evidence, right? You have physical evidence. And that's what we're all looking for. We're looking for that physical thing that we can tie to the paranormal event that happens. And then you have testimonial evidence, which, When people say, you know, I have eyewitness testimony, mm-hmm. Okay, that's what it is. It's testimonial evidence. It's anecdotal evidence from this person you could equate to. It is not physical evidence, and our senses trick us a lot more than other human beings can trick us. You know, you have your five senses, and there's all kinds of things that can happen with those five senses that will lead to confusion in your brain. And I won't go into it too much, but we're all blind. We think that we see, but we really don't. And what I mean by that is light is not going through our eyeball and projecting this image on the back of our brain. The electromagnetic spectrum radiation is going into our eyes, and it's being sensed in the back of our eye, and then it is transferred into a chemical and electronic process that goes through the optic nerve into the back of the brain, and one third of the brain is then interpreting and recreating everything that we see. So that's where that, you know, we were talking earlier as far as what kind of hallucinations and delusions can somebody have? Well, if you have a mental illness, that, you know, the visual spectrum can get pretty twisted up, and you can have different things happening simultaneously while you're functioning in the world, and you can have these images. So all of these things kind of lead up to this confusion that people say, well, you know, I have an eyewitness that this happened to. Well, that's fine. Let's vet the eyewitness. Let's make sure that there's, you know, no chemicals in there. Were they really drunk when this happened? Were they really high when this happened? Were they on some sort of other legal pharmaceuticals when this happened? Is there a physical, you know, reason why they might have a mental illness, or do they have epilepsy, or do they have, you know, any kind of eye condition that would lead to, you know, diffusion of what they're seeing, halos or whatever around,
correct,
you know, lights. There's just so much stuff.
Yeah, like cataracts, glaucoma.
Yeah, there's all of that. So, you know, you have the physical evidence, you have the testimonial evidence, and, you know, a lot of people talk about empirical evidence. Well, I want empirical evidence of what happened, and they get that confused with physical evidence. Empirical evidence is experiential evidence. Sir Francis Bacon, you know, he was the basically the founder of the scientific method, or one of them. And he believed in empiricism, and empiricism is empirical evidence. And the definition of that is the only way you can know something is to experience it through the senses. That's what he believed. And he was a realist. You know, I mean, he didn't, he was not a ghost hunter, but that's what he believed. Mm-hmm. He believed that you had to experience things through the senses in order to make sense of them. And so that's what I kind of look at more often now, is that sort of behavior and what we can glean out of that is, what is this person's experience, and can we vet them? I always say, you know, well, why are they telling you this story? Are they trying to, did you tell them that you're going to write a book about ghost hunting and they wanted to tell their ghost story so they could be in your book? Or do they own a bar and they want you to come to the bar and say that the bar is haunted so that they can advertise that their bar or restaurant or hotel is haunted so they can get more patrons in there?
Yes, absolutely.
Or they just, or it's truly just coming up and saying, man, I had this experience. Can you help me figure out what it is?
Yes. Oh, well, you touched a nerve, Greg.
I was going to say, you're probably thinking the same thing.
I am thinking the same thing.
Let's not use names.
No. But
we're not. But there
is another
certified
group. Yes. There is a group that operates in the same region that we do, and they're a fairly large group, and at this point I haven't heard much from them in a while.
No, I haven't either.
But they did exactly what you just said. This location, shall we say, this, you know, purveyor of services wanted more business, and this was during the ghost craze. And so they brought this team in, and this team did an investigation, and I'm air quoting, an investigation, and then certified with a certificate and everything that this location is haunted. We certify this as haunted. Now, it's after 9 o'clock.
I missed my calling on that
one. Yeah, I think of the money, you know.
And it is proudly displayed at the establishment.
Now nice. I have no problem at all if they really, you know, were experiencing things, and I have no problem with other ghost, you know, investigators, detectors, hunters, you know, whatever you want to call this group. I have no issue with them, except, like you said, what was their intentions, and then how in the crap? Well, I can say it. It's after 9 o'clock. Well, how in the hell can you certify a location as haunted?
Well, I would love to see what their baseline is and how they determine this, you know, because in order to, you know, if you're using any kind of method of detection, you have to have a baseline, whether you're trying to detect light or sound or pressure. You know, you have to have a baseline, and the science of measurements is mathematics. So I want to know how they're certifying anything based on, you know, what is their baseline. And don't get me wrong. The interesting thing about a lot of groups out there, or a lot of investigators, is they do not want to share, their information, and when you question their information, they can get
hostile.
Very nasty about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as opposed to the scientific community, you know, I'm a scientific materialist. I want particular things that I can measure. Even if you go, okay, I have 10 criteria, and in each one of those criteria, I have 1 to 10, 10 being the strongest, 1 being the weakest. And I rate this criteria based on, you know, this little graph that I have, And anything over a 75 means that it's likely that something's going on here. And if I get 100, that means I can't explain what is going on here because it is crazy. Because if you say it's haunted, you know, this is truly haunted. Well, is it? You sure it's not a djinn? Are you sure it's not a demon? Are you sure it's not a shapeshifter or dimensional, you know, traveler or time traveler? Or so when you're talking about paranormal, what I want is I want that 100% anomalous, because I don't know what it is unless it truly has abducted me, taken me to the mothership and done its you know, its experiments on me, sent me back, and I can go, you know what, I don't care where you guys rate this, I got abducted, and that's what happened. So you know, and if you're not using a baseline, and if you're, you know, on one investigation, you go in and you set up all your electronic equipment, and you sit back and you're passively listen for an hour, and then you go in and you threaten the ghost to come out, or, you know, don't be a coward and you know, doing that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or you set bait out, you know, if it was a little kid and you put some, you know, toys out there to see if the toys
trigger all two p.m.
Yeah. So, and every investigation you do something different, well, you will never create a baseline. And I understand that all investigations are different, but your measurements that you're trying to glean from this is incredibly important. And you know, if you're using your K2 meter to find ghosts, well, we can have a whole show on that.
Yes.
And you know, I have some stud finders that I can stamp a ghost detector on, and you can go
and certify it.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I'm making fun of it, but I'm making fun of the people that don't understand how a K2 meter works. And have done no research, and they've watched a TV show, and they buy a K2 meter, and they go in and it flashes green, and they think, oh, you know, there's a paranormal thing happen. No, it's just there's a disruption in the electromagnetic field right where you are, and it could be the fluorescent lights, you know, that mm-hmm. are above your head, or the short in the wall, or you know, a radio transmission from one of the radios that you guys are carrying,
or cell phone.
cell phones, classic, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I've talked to Frank Sinelli about different ways of doing stuff. Frank, Dr. Spector there, I don't know if y'all know him or not, but, you know, like I said, coming from a scientific side of it, I don't want anybody, let's say if I have a paranormal location, I don't want anybody to disturb it or, you know, minimal disruption before I get there. I want to send a psychic in first, or, you know, a sensitive or a medium or whatever you want to call them. I want to send that person over there first and let them wander around and do whatever they want to do and come on out of there and don't tell me what's going on and just go hang out or go home and we'll talk to you later, whatever, you know, however you want to do it. Mm-hmm. But I would like to have that link of something that I don't understand. This person is, you know, has either an ability or a skill or a gift that allows them to think a different way or perceive things a different way. So by letting them go in there before we set up cameras, before we do any measurements or anything like that, in my theory, that, you know, place is clean and they can go in there and do that. But once we introduce, you know, 5-6 more human beings, that's a whole bunch of more radio frequency energy that's going in there. Then you have your radios and you have your, you know, cameras or whatever else you're putting in that space is going to disrupt all of it. So if you do that first, in theory,
yes,
you know, that wouldn't happen. And Frank has a different idea on it. You know, I want this clean environment to try to do my measurements. And Frank has an idea of, look, you know, he believes that there are entities that what gets them active is human beings acting together and doing things. And that human interaction actually stimulates an attraction of some sort or create some sort of environment that exposes the paranormal or the experience. So, you know, until we can figure out what these things are that that people are dealing with, it's hard to say definitively one thing or the other, because all of us are doing different experiments. And until we can kind of get on the same page and say, this is the kind of experiment we want to do, this is another experiment, this is another experiment, and we kind of set up some ground rules, that way your group can go into the same spot that my group came in. And if we get very similar readings, very similar experiences, that would lend credibility to that. But if I have five groups and one goes in and says there's an alien there, another one goes in there and says, you know, they experienced orbs, another person said that they experienced tactile movement and things being pushed around, another one experiences voices, and another one experiences, you know, whatever, you know, smells or whatever, that's random. That's just random. We have no correlation on anything, and it's really hard to try to figure it out. And I would love to talk to those guys that could certify it's haunted. That's awesome.
And there you have it.
There it is. Sorry. I sucked the air out of the room, didn't I?
Well, no.
You're watching people just drop off of the net.
No. Well, we still have Russia. We'll always
okay,
have Russia.
Okay, well, as long as we have Russia.
Yeah, we're good.
I'm going there one day. I'm telling you. We have a Russian restaurant in Austin that my wife took me to for my 50th birthday, and it was great. They have 70 flavors of vodka.
Thought it was a restaurant.
Well, yeah. You know, yeah. It was good.
Only kidding.
But, you know, and that kind of leads to what we're looking at is like, what causes a haunting? What is this? And that's why I like doing the non-sexy stuff first, as far as doing the investigation and going, yeah, this place, you know, could really lend itself to a haunting. But then the argument is anything could, right? Because if you just look at Central Texas, you know, and you look at contemporary history, human beings supposedly crossed the Beringy Land Bridge up in Alaska when the Ice Age had lowered the sea levels, and people from Asia came into North America and migrated down and possibly created the Aztec or the Inca empires and et cetera, et cetera. Well, that would have brought us back about 6,000 years. Well, there's a site in Central Texas that is dated at over 16,000 years. Now, that is old. And so if we've had human beings running around in this area for 16,000 years, they're buried everywhere. There's all kinds of things that happened everywhere. Where I am in Georgetown, we have the San Gabriel River. Prior to the Revolution of Texas, it was called the San Xavier River, and there was three Spanish missions on it. And there were murders that happened there. There were all kinds of atrocities that happened to the Indians that the Spanish, the Spanish soldiers committed against the Indians. And so you can always fall back with, well, I don't have any contemporary evidence of a murder here. I don't have any police reports. You know, this house is only 30 years old before this house was built. This was a goat farm. And prior to that, no one owned this land. It was just Indians that ran around in here. And so you can always fall back on, you know, well, you're buried on an Indian graveyard, or this is a spiritual part for the Indians that were here, or, you know, there was some Indians on the warpath and they killed multiple people on this site.
It's not a virgin land.
No, it's not. People have been here. Mm-hmm. There's another site that they're actually, I'm scared to say this on the radio, but they're actually talking a 30,000-year-old find here in Texas, and that would, of course, wipe out all of our contemporary history. I believe that there's some flaws in the dating of this particular site, but we do have a good 16,000-year-old site that's. You know, is supported through peer-reviewed articles and other scientific, you know, testing and that sort of thing. So, you know, you can always fall back on that sort of thing. But I still, you know, talk a lot about what, as a paranormal detective, how can you look at an experience that is happening at a location or specifically to a person at multiple locations and tie it to some sort of haunting, and what is a haunting. In August 20th through the 23rd, I'll be speaking at the Michigan Paracon up in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And I'm speaking on Friday about what causes a haunting. And on Saturday, I'll be doing an evaluation of paranormal evidence workshop. And that's kind of where I'm going is if we're going to do this, if we're going to spend time doing this. You know, we need an organization that kind of sets the rules for us. And mm-hmm. we all, you know, look at in, you know, as an attorney, you have to follow rules. As a doctor, you have to follow rules. As a mechanic, you have to follow rules. Mm-hmm. And everybody is certified. And it would be great, you know, if we could get certified, at least to understand how to use a K2 meter. Mm-hmm. And not chase yourself in a circle after your phone.
Exactly.
Your phone and your back. I'm serious. I've seen people do it before. You know, phone's in their back pocket, and they hadn't turned it off, and they keep going in a circle, and there's a reason.
It's behind me. It's behind me. It's behind me.
It is great because 4 hours later when we're at the bar, it's hilarious, you know. And it would be nice if we had that. You know, even if it was an online kind of thing, you know, a 4-hour deal, yeah. That just talked about definitions of what we're talking about, and mm-hmm. then real tools that we can use and how to use those tools, and then how to interpret the data from the tools. So,
you know,
that's my dream.
Well, you know, and it's not a bad idea at all. And I know it's been brought up by other people pardon me for thinking this way, you know, it's kind of a military way of thinking about it. But who would be setting the rules? I mean, who would we select? How would we go about, you know, the confirmation panels? You know, who has the credibility?
And that's the big problem is, you know, how do you do that? Because if you go to just a complete scientific community, well, they're going to shut the whole thing down. If you go to a metaphysical community, they're going to do certain things. If you go to a psychologist or psychiatrist, they're going to go a different way. Mm-hmm. So it would be very difficult.
Maybe we need a whole panel from different areas.
Right. There are some organizations that are trying to do a lot of that. There's a organization out of the United Kingdom that they're much more scientific and much more skeptical on what's going on, but they at least entertain experiments, and most of their experiments are like long-term experiments. They're like years. They get permission to set up cameras. And actually collect data, so they're mining data on what they're seeing and what they're doing, and they're looking for patterns in that data and see if it makes any sense or not. You know, it's really funny. There's a location in France that a lot of people go to in order to pray and to heal the sick. And one of the people that run that organization, you know, will say, millions of people come here. You know, we have hundreds of thousands of people come here every year. And you ask them, well, you know, how many miracles have you had? Well, we have 60 confirmed miracles.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's probably less than the random random data of sick people recovering on their own. You know, if you have 1 million visitors and you have 60 miracles of people that had cancer that actually, you know, got better, I bet just a random sample, more than 60 people out of 1 million who have cancer get better, or it goes into remission. Mm-hmm. So where, once again, where's your median? Where is your baseline that we're measuring this stuff off of?
And you bring up a whole, let me chase this rabbit since it's right here in front of me.
Go.
I'm going to catch that rabbit.
Which way did he go?
You know, we have 60 confirmed miracles, 60 confirmed healings. Was that due to the place, or was that due to the person believing that this place would heal them and they did the work themselves?
Right. You know, but you know, and faith is, a belief devoid of evidence. That's what faith is. Now, I'm not attacking religion when I say that, because you have a lot of anecdotal, you have a lot of witness testimony for religious belief. I don't have a problem with that. I just, certain religious belief gets brought under scrutiny. And I give this example of how religions evolve, because you have religious tenets that are set, religious rules, and as society moves on, they go, oh, you know, we used to do this, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense anymore, so we're not going to do it anymore. And I always fall back on, I was an altar boy. I spent a lot of time in the Catholic Church. I'm confirmed Catholic. The whole mystery of the Eucharist. A lot of people don't realize when a Catholic priest, is at the altar, mm-hmm. and he performs the mystery of the Eucharist, and he actually transforms the bread into the body of Christ and the wine into the blood of Christ. It's not symbolic. In contemporary Christianity, you know, it's you say the words and it's symbolic, and what it's about, it's about breaking bread together. It's about sitting down at a table and having dinner and talking together and witnessing together. And sharing thoughts and feelings and beliefs together. But on the Catholic side, the mystery of the Eucharist is truly transubstantiation. It is the transformation of bread into the body, you know, of Jesus, and the blood into the, or in the wine into the blood. So, you know, and like I said, I'm Catholic. I will die Catholic. That's what I was raised as. But I've been to a lot of masses, and it doesn't look any different when they do it. You know, it still looks like a piece of bread to me. And it's, people will say it's symbolic. Well, no, that's not what it was. You can say in 2017 that it was that's symbolic. Well, that's not what the religion intended it to be. And you can turn your religion into whatever you want to, and you can change the rules if you want to, but that kind of takes away from the faith, the belief. And so those are kind of core things that I bring up, because so often, you know, people of a religious mind will steer away from the paranormal. And I think I think the paranormal is a lot more normal than what people want it to be.
Yeah. Well, when did this big, you know, when did the split happen? You know, back, you look at ancient cultures, the paranormal was blasé. I mean, it was everywhere. It was just an accepted part of life. And, yeah. and today, well,
in the 1850s, 1860s, people had seances at their house on Saturday night, went to church Sunday morning and talked about them. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a big deal until later. People were looking for answers, and were looking for, air quotes, the truth through other means than their religious leader in their town. Mm-hmm. So their religious leader in their town will lose power, will lose influence when this happens. So the only way to gain that back is to try to gain the trust back, or to force them back into line and back into the flock by threatening them with hell and damnation and everything else. You know, if you there in law enforcement, you have you have to have culpable mental states. In Texas, you have intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, and with criminal negligence.
Ah.
So you can throw the same thing into the paranormal, you know, intentionally, knowingly, you know, recklessly, or with negligence. And so are you intentionally trying to summon demons and have them attack your friend so that he'll die and you can take over his house and his wife and his kids? No. You know, or are you doing something reckless to let that happen, or are you negligent? Or are you simply just trying to find some answers by doing a seance or using a Ouija board or whatever you're scrying, or you're looking in a crystal ball, whatever you're doing? What is your intent? Is your intent evil, or is your intent trying to find answers to things that you're not able to get someplace else? So I think that intent has a lot to do with it.
Absolutely.
My opinion.
I mean, you couldn't have put it any better than that. You know, why are you doing this? You know,
right.
What for? But I mean, you know, that's a good explanation, you know, for the religious world, but what about the secular world? Even they've kind of like, you know, all that stuff is crap. You know,
right.
That stuff is all fake. You know, that stuff don't work. You know, where did they, you know, kind of fall off?
Well, and I think people start putting blinders on. There's so much pressure in life with the people that you just think about it in first or second grade. It started then, or it started maybe even before that, to try to conform. They wanted you to conform. They would ridicule you if you did not conform with the way that they behaved or the way that they thought. So, you know, that doesn't stop in that. And the interesting thing is most people have some sort of belief. And oftentimes when they don't understand somebody else's belief, they ridicule it. You know, I do a talk called Maintaining Credibility in Your Paranormal Investigation. And in that, I start off with, as soon as you walk into a room and the conversation starts and they say, oh, what do you do? And you say, I'm a ghost hunter. You know, half the people's eyes in the room will roll. They'll go, oh, my God. You know, half the people will walk away from you, go, oh, excuse me, or pick up their phone and go, I got a phone call. I got to talk now.
Rescue call.
Get away from you like it's a grenade and they need to clear the blast area. So it's those preconceived notions of what's going on, and they automatically pass judgment on you. There's a guy named Jeffrey Daugherty. He's written a couple of books, and the titles of his books are pretty pretty harsh. As far as he was an evangelical preacher, and he is the called himself the Christian whistleblower now.
Oh, and, yes, I've seen him.
Yeah, Jeffrey's great, man. I love him. He's got a very interesting perspective on what's going on, and it goes right back into the bottom line is, I think most of us, or any of us that are doing any of this, even if you're a very staunch non-denominational Christian that is reading their Bible, they're looking for things. We're searching for things, and it's inherent in the human spirit. In esotericism, there's a question of perennialism, and perennialism being, what was the catalyst? What was the thing that stimulated the human mind to say, is there something else? You know, because a cat or most animals, they just take their environment as is. They just look at things and go, you know, I need someplace to sleep. I need to be safe. I need to find some food. I might play around a little bit, but I got to get back and get safe again. You know, at some point, whether you believe in creation or whether you believe in evolution, at some point we looked up to the sky and said, is there something more to me? Is there more to this existence? And people argue all the time that creationism evolution. And who's to say, you know, the creationists say, well, God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh. Who's to say that God's years aren't a billion?
Yes,
I mean, God's
exactly.
days are a billion years long. Hmm. You know, if he's eternal, well, that would make sense in my mathematical computation. I would go, okay, that makes sense. So maybe, that first billion years, that was his first day, and he's, you know, creating some stuff and packing the dirt together, and okay, I'm doing that. Either or, maybe that's the way evolution was designed to be created, or maybe not. I don't know. I wasn't there. But the theory still last is what stimulated us to do this, because it's inherent in everybody. We all ask that question, and whether it's from a religious standpoint and we answer it through, you know, religious dogma or, you know, ancient writings, or it's the other way where we're talking amongst ourselves and trying to figure it out ourselves and paying attention to the sky and our feelings late at night when we're contemplating this and searching within ourselves, what more is there? And I think that's the search. That's the important thing is that we don't just give up and go, okay, well, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. What's beyond mm-hmm. this? Without this body, this $50 in chemicals, what makes me me, and where am I going to go?
Right, and I think that science is answering some of that stuff. If you look at, you know, I mean, Carl Sagan, he wanted to know that answer before he died. He wanted to know. Neil deGrasse mm-hmm. Tyson, he will talk down about religion, he is still there to help them.
Mm-hmm.
To try to help make sense of things. Stephen Hawking's putting stuff together, and all the people that are working on quantum mechanics right now and string theory, we have this geometric assumptions idea that our world is 3D, you know, that we have height, depth, and width, and that's how we experience our whole life, to include time, because if you're measuring something, it takes time for you to measure it. So we actually live in a 4D world. And these geometric assumptions wrap us into, real restrictions. And all of these astrophysicists and cosmologists and everything are saying, no, we're not in a 3D world. Our calculations aren't telling us this. We are in something much more. There's a multiverse. There's a parallel universe. There's multi-layered universe, which may explain heaven and hell. You know, if you're doing a calculation, you're like, well, there's not enough mass here to make whatever it is do whatever it's doing, then there has to be something outside that is affecting it. And that's what all these scientists, the real scientists that are doing the calculations, are saying, there is something more. And I think that it will help us explain what you and I are looking for.
That's awesome. Greg, you just dumped a basket of rabbits.
Sorry.
No, but, we're quickly running out of time, though. So, how can somebody get in touch with you, Greg, and look, you know, purchase your book, Detecting the Paranormal?
You can join me at the Sage Paracon in Warwick, England, on September 28th. I'll be talking about paranormal perceptions there. I'm going to be doing a British invasion tour. Or you can go to my website. It's www.theparanormaldetective.com or www.authorgreglawson.com.
Oh, this has been wonderful. We've been honored by you joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
And
it was fun. And learned a lot, too.
And you know how to tell if you're...
I did, too.
Here's another difference between a ghost hunter and a paranormal detective. You'll know they're a hunter when they go into a 500-year-old German castle and they're looking for EVPs in English.
Yeah.
So
it's beautiful. They have that universal translator, don't they? I think all of them have I don't know. Maybe not.
I don't know. Does my ovilus speak German? I don't know.
That is beautiful, and I have seen that, and it's the definition of irony.
Yes, it is. But Greg, thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
And we'd like to have you on again very, very soon.
Anytime.
Awesome. Well, good night, Greg.
Good night. Thank you.
Well, that was an awesome show. I mean, wasn't it good just to come home?
It was. Very comfortable.
Yes. Talking about ghost detecting, paranormal detecting. And, you know, everything he said was just good, practical sense.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, he is one of the first, though, and I really appreciated this. He's one of the first, though, that said that it doesn't matter what time of day it is, a haunt is a haunt is a haunt.
It is. I mean, they don't have certain hours like, oh, it's time to go haunt something someplace. You know, it's like we don't punch a time clock to do that. So
exactly. Yeah. You know, there's only been one theory that I've heard, and this was back when I was actually studying parapsychology in college. There was a theory that spirits may be more active at night because there's less microwave radiation from the sun. And maybe that would, you know, the absence of that microwave would, you know, allow the spirits to be more active. But beyond that, every other reason is just purely practical.
Yes.
So I really appreciated it when he said that, because, you know, whenever you schedule an investigation, we've all done it. You call the client and they're like, well, okay, well, you know, when do you guys want to start? At 9:30? Are you kidding me? I really would like to be packing up my equipment around that time.
Yeah.
I am old, I'm tired,
yeah, we're not
I'm broken.
Here for the night, you know, we're not having a slumber party.
Yeah, we're not, you know, doing the paranormal lockdown. We're going to be locked in for 3 days. Yeah. Well, you can call Nick Groff
call Nick or Zach or somebody too.
Oh, speaking of Zach, and I'm almost ashamed of myself for saying this, you know, we pride ourselves about not talking bad about other investigators in the field, but I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up. Have you seen that Zach Baggins is opening up the Zach Baggins Paranormal Museum in Las Vegas?
I heard about that. I think he's trying to take after John Zaffis.
That's... I'm looking at Kathy. She's sitting right there. Did I not say that?
Yeah.
That he saw the attention that John Zaffis has gotten from that. But people that are moving stuff in, it's supposed to open in July. And, you know, the government has leaks. Well, so does the paranormal world. That a lot of the, quote, artifacts are simply him taking pictures at locations of himself.
Really?
So I really hope that he's got some exhibits that are, you know, that I would want to see.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, if I want pictures of Zach, I just Google him.
Well, yeah. But hopefully, you know, he's done everything he needs to do to take care of those artifacts that he's collecting, if he has any.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure they're safe to be around. And
yeah, because John, I mean, you know, I guess my problem is with the credibility. You know, Zach has been through he's been through the rites. He's been through he's done all the rites of passage. Because I remember I remember Zach long before he had a show, and I know he's taken his lumps and stuff, but the credibility is in question here. If you're going to do that, you know, how are you making these items safe? What safeguards are you taking? Because John Zaffis takes that very, very, very seriously. And he comes from a family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's what, third, fourth generation that of people that have taken that very seriously, you know, with Ed, Lorraine, you know, Tony, you know, and now his daughter's taken over the reins.
Right.
They're very deep and steeped in the education, whereas it seems the Ghost Adventures crew is more into the sensation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at me, look at me, look at me. You know, aren't I cool? You know, look what I'm doing, and pro, you know, antagonizing the spirits, and you know.
Well, you know, there's a lot to be said about ego.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
You know, Lego my ego.
Yeah.
But anyways. Oh. Uh-oh, there's the music.
Did he sneak in the back door there?
You know, I don't even think he snuck today. I think he just walked in.
Did he?
Yeah.
Let the door slam behind him.
Yeah, he's pulling the chairs out from under us tonight.
Well,
because okay. you got a busy day ahead of you tomorrow.
I do. I got to get up early, so I'm going to be heading to bed here really quickly.
Yeah.
Even though it's what time is it? It's 8 o'clock here, so yeah, I'm gonna be in bed by 9 because I have to get up at 4. So
yes, me. Well, it's 10 o'clock here, and I'm gonna be in bed at 10:05. But everybody, you have been listening to The Buzz on ztalkradio.com. This is the 12th of June, 2017. Now, I put the challenge out there at the beginning of the show, and I plan to keep my word. We have already been sent one request of somebody that one of our listeners thinks would be a good guest. So I'm actually going to give them a call tomorrow and see if I can't get them on next week. And
yeah, don't be shy.
Yes, please.
Because I know there's people out there that you'd like to hear. So, you know, we're all in for getting them on the show.
Yes, this isn't the Kevin Thompson show or the Molly Spence show. This is The Buzz. This is a community. So if you have somebody you want to hear, we will try. And it would kind of be a nice cap on tonight's discussion where we talked about detecting the paranormal. This couple are a married couple that are demonologists.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be kind of interesting to get their take on tonight's discussion.
Yeah. I'd like to hear from some of our listeners in other countries that are listening to us.
Yes, we know you're out there.
You know, maybe you know of people that would be great guests on the show that we don't even know about.
Yeah, tonight
help us out.
Yeah, we have the Russian Federation on tonight. If they could get me in touch with Putin, I'd be much appreciative.
Be careful what you ask for.
Well, yeah, I know. There for a while, I was sitting near Putin anyway, so.
I'm glad I'm here and not there.
All right, everybody. I think you've had just about enough of me. So for tonight, I'm saying good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody, and have a great week.
We'll see you again next Monday night, 8 p.m. Central, right here on ztalkradio.com.
This has been a production of the Ztalk Radio Network.